that's what I'm talking about.
Call the meeting of the Health Committee to order, and just sort of remind ourselves of the process for today. The committee is going to begin the difficult work on a omnibus health finance bill in the next days, and we will soon have targets. As a matter of fact, Ways and Means, I think, is going to be discussing targets, flowing kind of discussion amongst the team. But we have asked members to bring to the committee prepared language. In some cases, I think you're going to see that we actually have bill language. In other cases, you're going to see that it's draft language. I'm going to ask, the Republican team has been working now for a few weeks, really, in trying to sort through ideas, find the ones, beginning to get some sort of sizings on them. So I'm going to go through about a half a dozen Republican proposals that have reached a point, I think, where we can share. The intention today is to understand and not criticize. I think we're looking for ideas. This is a kind of a brainstorming opportunity, a structured brainstorming. I don't think we need to criticize each other's ideas. Whether or not the ideas are able to be incorporated remains to be seen. But I know as the person primarily responsible for creating the start point in an omnibus bill, I'm certainly open to good ideas. The ideas, and just to remind people, need to be framed in terms of alternative savings, alternative prioritization, improved efficiencies, those kinds of things that might be used to offset some of the things. For example, you know, and I haven't asked for this, but I think I can sense in the committee that there's a very strong desire in this committee to be able to provide rate increases for the continuing care spectrum of group homes, ICFMRs, mental health providers, home health care providers, for which in the governor's budget there's no allocation for a rate increase. Well, members, if you recall House File 775, and I think I must be approaching almost all of the members having signed on to that bill, the price tag for that in the next biennium is $110 million. If we were trying to do just that one by itself, you can see sort of the extent of the challenge that this committee has, and I can't promise that we can do all of that. But at least what I think it shows is that there are some areas which I think we would all agree are pretty high priority that we need to see if we can be creative, be smart, do the right kinds of things where maybe we can freeze some funds in order to be able to support those kind of priorities. And I only gave that as an example. I don't mean that that's the only item. There certainly are. I know I have a list myself that I've been sort of trying to keep track of. But we're not here today to decide where to spend. We're here today to see if we have some ways of opportunities to create spending opportunities. And the only way that's going to happen is for the things that we can do in the purview of this committee. So with that, I'd like to begin. Representative Paul, I think you have an idea in emergency care. So if we could distribute your idea.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since I've been in the legislature, we've had several instances where we've had testifiers come to our committee and testify that some of the most expensive medical care that we provide to our clients is in the emergency departments. And people have scratched their heads wondering how we get them out of there and how we get them directed to a more appropriate place where they can receive care. So I've thought about that. And to back up a little bit, one of the problems that they have enunciated as being one of the blockades for directing people in the correct place has been the federal EMTALA law, which is the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, which generally gets described as meaning that the emergency room physicians and emergency room personnel are forced to see folks and to treat them in the emergency departments. After looking over the EMTALA laws here in the last few months, and this has not been something I've done just in the last few days, it's been in the last few months, I've come to the conclusion that the EMTALA law, and I believe I'm right about this, only requires that emergency departments screen for an emergency medical condition, and if they find that emergency medical condition exists, then they need to treat and stabilize that patient. However, if a non-emergency, if an emergency situation isn't present, then they do not have to treat that patient. In fact, they could go right ahead and direct that patient to a more appropriate place for care. The screening does not have to be done by a physician as well. It can be done by another type of healthcare professional, a nurse, for example. So what my bill does is just says, pretty simply, is that for medical assistance, we're not going to cover non-emergency visits to a hospital emergency room. With some discussions with the department, we don't know how this would be scored. They have not seen this. They've not had this in their possession for very long. So we'll be working with the department to see just what we can do, if how much savings would be realized here. But I think it would be fairly significant. Because I tell you, in my experience, dealing in emergency rooms and ambulances, that we see a lot of people in emergency rooms with basically snot-nosed kids. And they certainly do not have an emergency medical condition that has to be seen in an emergency room. They'd be better off, I think we'd all agree, in a primary physician's clinic. So that, in a nutshell, is that amendment.
For clarification, Representative Powell?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Powell, maybe you might have this, you might be talking about this already. Is there sort of like a list that you have in mind on what's an emergency and what might not be?
Representative Powell.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Powell. An emergency medical condition is defined in the EMTALA federal statute. There is a bit of gray area. However, it certainly does, I think, just by looking at it, does screen out a significant number of folks. Now, who those are, it certainly is not enunciated in law. But I would think that would be something the department would have to search out and decide on its own just exactly what that definition meant and what type of conditions that would be covered.
Okay. Representative Paul, that might be something helpful to hear, perhaps even just at least a reference to the federal laws that you're talking about. Representative Top. Representative Huntley?
Mr. Chair and Representative Paul, at least the two hospitals in Duluth that have emergency rooms have urgent care setups right next to them, so that patients get screened, and if they're not emergency, they just get in the waiting line at urgent care. So in that situation, I don't think it would make much difference.
Representative Powell? Sounds like that would be what you intend to.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Huntley, that does fit in with, I think that's appropriate. That should be done. If they're not, if the EDs and urgent cares are two different places, and if they can be screened to an urgent care, then I think that would be an appropriate thing to do.
Further questions, members, for clarification? None. Thank you, Representative Powell. Why don't we do, I'm sorry, Representative Thiessen.
This is kind of a naive question, but what is it, why are emergency rooms more expensive than urgent care for kind of treating the same conditions? I just don't know the answer, if you could.
Representative Powell, do you have a sense of their algorithm?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, I do not know either. I don't have a definitive answer for that.
But I think that's probably a fair question. My hunch is, and because I've discussed with hospitals frequently, why if somebody comes in and not much of anything happens, they still have a bill for tens of thousands of dollars. It seems like it's just the algorithm of cost recoveries that are involved. Emergency rooms are pretty expensive overheads. So you walk in the door, if you're serviced, there's an automatic cost recovery kind of thing. That's the answers I've had.
I will say this, Mr. Chairman, that I was at a Twin Cities ER this session on a visit, and I asked them what their average charge was, and that's for everybody. But their average charge, not including a physician, they told me, was $1,000.
Just coming in,
and you know, from the whole range of things, though, from the very bad to the very simple, the average bill was $1,000.
I think, in fact, it's sort of a fascinating discussion. You know, we had a discussion about swing beds. Yeah. If you recall, it's kind of an interesting phenomenon that for the same services, there was a several-fold difference in the costs. And I mean, I understand how a business has to recover overhead, just that it doesn't seem to work very well sometimes when you're trying to compare services, like services. Thank you. Representative Powell, no further questions. I think we'll move on to Representative Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Powell, I got in here a little late, and I apologize. I just wondering why this is not a bill right now, and we're just discussing the possibility of this being included, or what's the plan here?
Mr. Chairman, yeah. Representative Goodman, I think what I was doing is just basically following the chair's directions on bringing some ideas to the committee that we could discuss in an open and honest public way. And this is just one of them.
And Representative Goodman, that's exactly the direction that we gave. We're still open to ideas. It's not unusual to see ideas emerging as we have targets and things get more specific. So asking for today in a very open kind of way for ideas that could be amendments that could be included in an omnibus bill.
Oh, then, Mr. Chair.
Representative Goodman.
So this could be included in an omnibus bill even though it's not a bill and it's not getting a full hearing before the committee?
That's correct. Now remember, the omnibus bill will have a hearing.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair.
That's a good one.
You know, first of all, we've heard a lot of very controversial bills in here that have been laid over for possible inclusion, none of which we voted on. The omnibus bill, if all things considered or most things considered end up in it, is going to be a huge document. And we never had a chance to vote on these very significant issues individually. How much time are we going to spend on the omnibus bill when it comes?
It's a good rule, spend whatever time it takes. We've done that every year. We spend a lot of time. Hours and hours. That's a good one.
Sure. We have deadlines coming up the end of this month for the finance bill, and so when would we be starting the omnibus bill?
That's a good one. I'm targeting that we would have a bill put together for us to begin to have hearings and discussions next week, early next week, I hope.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Powell. Do we have Representative Pepin's proposal distributed, or is it in the process?
In the process of being distributed.
Okay.
But I can start if you'd like.
Certainly. That's independent.
Okay, my idea is I'm proposing a premium increase to Minnesota Care for adults and children. I'll start with the children first. My proposal would be $1 a month increase in premiums for children and families with income of less than $150% of the federal poverty guidelines. Currently, they pay $4 a month. And my proposal is to change that to $5 a month. I still think that would be a pretty good deal. That would be move from $48 to $68 a year and would yield about $250,000 in savings in fiscal year 06. The second part of my proposal would be an across-the-board 10% increase in premiums for people with income greater than 100% of the federal poverty guidelines after they have been calculated as a percentage of income. For example, let me see if I have a copy. So, for example, right now a family paying that has an income of $500 a month, they're currently paying $12 a month, and my proposal simply would be at 10% on top of that, so it would be an extra $1.20 a month. And so the more income a family makes, the higher their increase in premium would be. Does that make sense, Representative Bradley?
Representative Pippen, you had some numbers. You mentioned $250,000. Do you have, and was that for the entire proposal, or was that just one element of your proposal?
That was just the first part. That was just for the children.
Kind of a total number, Representative Pippen?
Yeah, and for so that was the $250,000 over for fiscal year 06 was just for the children. That would just be the dollar increase premium per month. In fiscal year 07, it would be $125,000 for that. For the 10% increase in premiums for people with income, the state share of the premium revenue in fiscal year 05 is about $25.2 million, and DHS has estimates that the 10% premium increase would yield $2.52 million. If adults with no children, without children are no longer eligible, the 10% premium increase would yield about $1.8 million for 06 and $1.7 million for 07 to 09.
And Representative Pepin, in 06, what's the total then, numbers of all those combined? Do you have that?
It would be, depends on which number we yield. Are you looking, are we going to count adults without children in my calculation? Because that would be 1.8. If we're, if we're using all of them, it would be 2.52.
Representative Pepin, I mean, I think to do this right, we should be doing it pretty much as a base off the governor's proposal. So if you're referring to the governor's proposal, which the adults without children, able-bodied adults without children would not be eligible, then we shouldn't count that really.
So then it would be $1.8 million for the adult portion and $250,000, so roughly $2 million in savings
about
for the proposal.
Is that the same in the second year of the biennium, or is that?
The second year would be slightly less because the estimate was $125,000 for the dollar a month increase on children. The second year wasn't clear as to why that was, but and it was also a little bit smaller for the adult section. So it would be $1.7 million plus $125,000, so it would be about $1.8 million over the second.
So roughly about $3.8 million for the biennium.
Correct.
This would yield. Questions for clarification, members? I would say that this is something I heard fairly frequently on the road of people saying that we should be considering this. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, would this premium then be used to prevent, this premium increase used to prevent people being cut from Minnesota Care?
Representative Goodwin, maybe you missed the discussion. I think that there are many priorities that this committee would have. I mentioned that from a personal level, I think one of the first is the rate increase for group homes, ICF and Mars, and so forth. And to give you kind of a measure, the House File 775 that you're probably a co-author on has a price tag in itself of about $110 million. So we're going to have to be realistic in how much we can do with the savings that we get. So I don't think anybody can promise where it would be applied. We'll have to apply whatever savings we can have in the best prioritization that we can.
And I can give you some more examples if you'd like. A family, I already mentioned a family of three making $500 a month. A family of three making $1,000 a month currently pays $18 for premium. This will increase it by $1.80, so they pay $19.80. So it's a 10% on top of the premium they currently pay. So for a family of three making $1,500 a month, the premium will go up an additional $5.50 a month. So instead of paying $55, they'd be paying $60.50.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Is it good?
You know, Representative Pepin, I think this is a good idea, and I think a lot of people would rather have an increase in premiums than lose their Minnesota Care, but I would like to see the two attached to each other because if people have told me in my district that they're very concerned about losing their health insurance and they would rather pay higher premiums than lose their health insurance. But there's nothing in here or in Representative Bradley's plan at this point, as it sounds, that it's going to say, you know, you pay higher premiums and then we'll make sure that you can still keep Minnesota Care or that others can keep Minnesota Care, and that's the problem with this bill.
First and foremost, as I said at the beginning, I don't want to turn this into kind of a debate about the merits of something, but I would at least, from just a numbers point of view, remind you that the governor's proposal on eligibility has a price tag of about $76 million. This is $3.8 million. This would not buy back eligibility. I mean, it's a small amount in comparison to the overall cost or the savings that the governor's budget has.
Well, Mr. Chair, we don't have to abide by what the governor has proposed. We're the legislative body, and we do what we wish to do. And I will say, in my travels around the state and in my district, people are willing to pay higher premiums on Minnesota Care as long as we don't kick anybody off, particularly the hardworking people of this state that are on Minnesota Care. I don't know why, in order to pay for increased wages in nursing homes, we have to kick people off of Minnesota Care when they're working people that have never been on welfare and don't want to be on welfare.
Well, let's try to honor the process. We want this process to be a let's listen to, let's understand, and let's not criticize. I think this is a legitimate idea before us. Where we apply it would be a matter that we will discuss. I will accumulate these and put forth an idea, and then you're always all free to make amendments to that as you wish. Representative Thiessen.
Representative Pepin, it sounds like you have some kind of sheet that lays out some of the premium. Is that something that could just at some point be passed around?
Yeah, I do have it. I just don't have copies of it.
Yeah.
We could make we have staff make copies of that. I kind of highlighted some of the figures. It's pretty straightforward, the calculation. But I do.
That'd be helpful.
Yeah, if our staff could follow up on that and make sure that all members of the committee then get a copy. That's fair. There's a lot of, you know, when you dig, sometimes you find some really helpful information about it. And these tables were helpful.
Mr. Chair, I think it's important that we do discuss the merits of the proposals if we're going to stay with that level. Then when we tell you about what we think should be done, are we going to be discussing the merits of that, or are we going to be told that our ideas won't work or whatever? Are we just going to listen to people's proposals? I mean, our job is to come here and discuss the merits of any proposal.
How many times do I have to remind you? There will be a bill, an omnibus bill, that I will put together on behalf of listening as carefully as I can to this committee. You will have every opportunity in that bill. Some of these things may never make it, and the one I recommend doesn't mean that you can't. We need to have an opportunity to hear. This is the input time for ideas. And there will be plenty of time, but if we sit here and concentrate on one of these and then try to rip it apart or do whatever, we're not going to get through. Today is the idea for us to put, the top opportunity for us to put ideas on the table. Simple as that. And that should be positive. That's very positive.
There's just one more thing I wanted to make in my proposal. Staff has put together some information that shows that Minnesotans that purchase health insurance from their employers in the private sector have faced 10 to 12% increases in premiums for multiple years in a row, and there hasn't been an increase in Minnesota Care premiums for a couple of years.
Okay, well, not selling the idea or criticizing the idea, just understanding the idea. Thank you. Emma, I think you have an idea. Let's go ahead and get that distributed.
Thanks. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House File 2394, I'll get into it in just a second, but I'll tell you where it comes from. As I, when I got here, knowing very little about Minnesota Care or some of the other programs, as I think most people on this committee do, I dove into whatever information was available. And resources available with respect to Minnesota Care was the 2003 auditor's report. Some interesting information that a newcomer finds when he reads one of these reports, and I assume all of the folks that have been here had an opportunity to read the report and probably understood it at first glance a lot better than I did. I had to read it several times. As you folks recall, and new folks like me probably aren't as in tune with it, the Office of the Legislative Auditor reviewed, and specifically the Program Evaluation Division, reviewed Minnesota Care and issued a report in January of 2003. The report was authorized by the legislature, and its objective was to determine, among other things, whether the program funded by the state was meeting its goals and objectives and was utilizing its resources effectively. Some of the history that you can find in the report, enrollment in Minnesota Care grew from 62,000 folks in fiscal year 1994 to about 144,000 in fiscal 2002, an increase of 130% in only 8 years. Of particular interest is that Minnesota Care only serves 3% of our population. Some of the other interesting facts cited by the auditor, from fiscal year 1998 through fiscal year 2002, the Healthcare Access Fund tax revenues increased by 23%, while Minnesota Care spending increased by 142%. As I got into more of it, I looked at the program as being something that's necessary, and I don't particularly believe everything that I hear on the TV or that I read in the newspaper. As I got into this and I found out that the law, when it was originally created, will take effect if this if the public fund is not adequate to meet the needs of the program, it'll take effect and start cutting people. And I keep hearing everybody talking about the governor cutting people from a program that I think is incredibly important to some folks in the state of Minnesota. The issue, though, that kept popping out at me was not this argument that both sides of the aisle seem to have over who's cutting what and who's not being fair to the those that are less fortunate and who's more fair. What kept popping out at me was, you know, the auditor found all kinds of errors in the administration of this program and made specific recommendations as to how the program might be administered more efficiently to make better use of the funds to the population that truly is in need of these funds. And I'll cite you to a couple of things that stood out in the report. The auditor's office noted that claim files did not contain sufficient proof of income with which to make an accurate income determination. According to the auditor's report, this error was noted when pay stubs did not cover 4 weeks of pay, were not current, or did not clearly indicate the pay frequency. For self-employed income, the error was noted when, for example, the worker made an income determination without having necessary tax returns. Interesting that among the cases in which the auditor found errors and was able to independently determine income, the income error resulted in premium difference in 63% of the cases, over half the cases. As I got through it, what this told me was maybe we're looking at it the wrong way. Instead of arguing about who's getting coverage and who's not getting coverage, I think a goal of both sides of the aisle is to make sure that we maintain the integrity of the program for the people that truly do need it. We may argue about who those people are, but I don't think we're going to argue about the program's goals, which is getting me to House File 2394. According to the auditor's 2003 report, MinCare can save $8 to $22 million just by verifying income and properly calculating income. If this program is, and I'll give you an example, in the auditor's report, it was cited that what originally was a 22 or 24 page application has since been reduced, I think, down to 2 pages. Now, granted, it's to make for ease in allowing people to access the program. The problem is it seems to be creating some serious issues in terms of accuracy of information. What I've done with House 2394 in an effort to try and address those problems, because I raised it with, and I make this mistake all the time, and I'm not too proud to be corrected every time, Department of Health or Department of Human Services, whoever it is that we deal with on this, I met with several of their individuals over a month ago, maybe a month and a half ago, and I raised a whole bunch of issues that I asked them to look into. Longer and more detailed application forms, more information and documentation. I had suggested shorter time periods for eligibility. I had suggested incentives for department folks and county folks that are administering the program. Give them some incentive to do their job a little bit better. By the way, in the auditor's report, for those that have not read it in a while, there was something that just stuck out like a sore thumb to me. There was an instant where personnel, government personnel, tried to verify income, and they were told that they should not do that because that's against department policy, which is why I've done this, and this is why I talked to them. I suggested incentives for applicants, which we're going to talk about in this bill. I suggested a surcharge on participant premiums that would go with those incentives, immediate self-reporting of income changes, and certain changes in employer verifications. House File 2394 doesn't address all of those. It just addresses a very small area. It addresses the verification, and it addresses some of the incentives. If you take a look at the first page, one of the things that I haven't talked about, which is covered on the very first page, has to do with who really was this program intended for. This program was intended for hardworking Minnesotans who have no other access to health care, and the idea was it's supposed to be there to carry them through the hard times and hopefully allow them to increase their position so that they can access the private health care system. Unfortunately, it looks to me like the system is being inappropriately accessed by... yes, sir.
Representative, could you take us through what the bill does?
Well, that's what I'm doing.
Okay. You're giving a little editorial about it. I'd like to really understand the substance of what the bill does.
That's what I thought I was doing. I apologize, Mr. Chairman. When I don't get paid to speak, I tend to run off at a moment.
Well, it's commendable, but we've got many proposals to look at today, so I want to make sure we all understand what you're actually proposing.
Well, I understand. It's not all about me. Mr. Chairman, on 2394, what I was getting at is you'll notice the language at the beginning of the bill tries to make it clear that this is not supposed to be a program for college kids. They should access their coverage through the university or some other means. All I did is ask the folks to tighten up the language so that this coverage is available to hardworking families that need it. Then if you get to page 3, you'll see that in tightening up the eligibility requirements, one of the things that I'm proposing is that immediate reporting of a change in income, whether it increases or decreases, right now it just provides for decreases, be reported so that we can recapture some of the significant funds that the auditor's office has pointed out. Then if you get to the end, page 5, I think, is an interesting proposal, and I thank the chairman for giving me all this time. This is the surcharge, and here's the intent, that we would add a surcharge of 2% to every premium payment with the idea that it goes into an account for the person or persons that are accessing the system. It's their money, and it'll work a couple different ways. It'll accumulate in the account. It will be there in the event that somebody does not accurately report their income and we've made an overpayment. The state can collect the overpayment from that account. Or if there's a situation where someone has purposely misreported and there's a penalty, you can collect it from that account. But the most significant part of the surcharge proposal and the account is that if a family reaches that stage where they can actually access private insurance, if there's money in the account, it goes with them. That's what the proposal is. Thanks for all your time.
Thank you. Questions, members? Representative Huntley?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, how does this fit in with Health Match? Or maybe the department would want to answer.
Mr. Chairman, I thought you wanted this to be short.
Well, the answer might be I don't know even.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. Representative Huntley, this is one of the things that I've talked to the department about as to the information that they will be collecting. But I think if this is in statute, it's something they're going to have to provide for in the program.
And I think, Representative Huntley, my hunch would be because it costs a ton of money to delay anything, mm-hmm. we'd have to make anything we do here effective after those things that might affect Health Match because it's extremely expensive for every month that we delay it. So we'd have to be pretty careful about the things. And I can't tell looking through it what might or might not affect Health Match.
but it is an interaction that we're going to have to figure out. Representative Huntley?
And Mr. Sharon, Representative Emmers, what in here relates to college students?
If you look at page one.
What?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, if you look at page one, if you look under the definition of child, what I'm proposing is tightening up the definition of child.
Well, Mr. Chair, what if they don't have the opportunity for health insurance through their university?
Representative Emmer? Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, the Minnesota Care Program was not intended for folks in that situation, in my humble opinion. We may have that disagreement. You might recall my comment earlier was, I think we all agree on the goals of the program. We might disagree on who the coverage is intended for and who's it, who it's not. If it's intended for hardworking families that are need something as a safety net, I think that's what we should maintain the integrity for.
Mr. Chair, and I just my comment is a large number of college students are financially independent, whatever the term is, from their parents, and all the college students I know are extremely hardworking.
Mr. Chair, I think it's
just a matter of if you understand that the debate, whether there is it. Whether the debate happens, if it's in the omnibus or not, will occur later. Today it's just a matter of understanding it. Okay. Representative Gugan.
Thank you. And Representative Emmer, how does this affect students that have children? Half-time students that it says, because basically I see it says, unless the student is age 18 or older and enrolled in a half-time or greater. So a half-time student working full-time or half-time with children, no health insurance. They'll still be eliminated, correct?
I don't think that's true, Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin. I don't think that's true in every case, no.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
where does it say that then, that unless they have children?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, I think it references dependent children throughout the... We're not trying to, in the words that some folks might pick, kick dependent children in need off of the program. Again, this proposal is simply trying to make the program, maintain the integrity of the program for those families that truly need the program.
Representative, if I understand then, it's your intent only in the case where someone may be claimed as a dependent that this would deal with. And if there is a need for clarification to what Representative Goodwin's talking about, that we could certainly handle it. It's kind of hard sometimes out of context because you don't necessarily see the whole statute sections that we're dealing with, but it's your intent that in the case of a minor who is actually a parent, that you would not expect this to apply, that they would be independently eligible for Minnesota Care if they're eligible. Is that fair?
Mr. Chairman, I'd have to agree with that. Yeah, that would be my
intent. You may need to be sure that that's a language, but that's your intent.
If somebody thinks that's not
a good
idea.
Mr. Chair, maybe we can get clarification from House Research on, I'm not talking about a minor child who is in a post-secondary institution. I'm talking about somebody over 18 that has children and is going to school to try to better their lives. So I wonder if that is, Mr. Chen could tell us if, how this reads.
Mr. Chen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Goodwin, I believe in that case, if the person, you said, is over 18 and has children and is in school,
correct,
that they would then be eligible as a parent or as a family. This is just applying to, you know, this defined group of individuals under 18 who are either full-time or part-time in college.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Powell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, on page 2, line 10 to 11, you have including unrelated persons. I personally know a lot of college students who maybe might be attending school far away, and they might be staying with people that they might not be related in the traditional sense, but maybe they're in the same clan or some. They're providing a room in their house for that student to stay there, but there's no relationship between the income sharing between the student and that family, that student would be unfairly treated under this proposal, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chairman, I mean, it's a matter of understanding that, so maybe you can explain what it does, and then you can have your own conclusion about what it should be.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's an excellent question. Unfortunately, it doesn't apply to the language that we're talking about. I'm glad you brought this up because I forgot to mention it. I think one of the areas in I've actually had contact from several folks once they found out that I was doing this about investigating different situations. What I'm proposing with that language is to redefine how we determine income. We have situations, and I'll give you one without names, where we've got a woman with two kids who lives with somebody who's earning six figures a year. They're not married. She goes in and presents her income, qualifies for Minnesota Care, and there's no questions asked. I don't believe that's the situation, and again, this is my humble opinion, I don't believe that's the situation that we intended Minnesota Care to cover. That seems to be an abuse. So what I've suggested here is something that we do in other areas of the law. We determine who is a member of a household. So when determining income for purposes of Minnesota Care or these programs where we're trying to determine where someone falls, we determine household income so we avoid those abuses.
Mr. Chair.
President Tal.
Representative Emmer, so the scenario that I just gave you, would that fit under your bill too? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think you and I'd have to sit down and work through that a little bit in more detail. When you talk about, no disrespect intended, but when you talk about a member of the same clan or different, I'm relating on a different level. I think you and I would have to sit down and talk about specific situations. This is intended to define income as all household income. Whether your specific situation falls in it or not, I can't tell you as I sit here, but I'd be happy to sit down and work through it.
I think it'd be helpful if you could do that. Yeah. I mean, your case, I think, is an easy one. I don't know for sure that I can relate to it, but if you could talk that over and see where we stand in terms of that ability.
Sure. I mean, I understand this is not a piece of refined legislation, but it's a start somewhere.
President Plummer?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Emmers, I'm just wondering how this would relate to what would happen if we passed the Defense of Marriage Constitutional Amendment and you had two lesbians living together raising kids. One of them was on Minnesota Care. Would they have to count the income of the other since the Constitutional Amendment would say that there's no rights available to the couple based on their relationship? What you're saying, there's a penalty, but they get no rights either.
Mr. Chairman, if I could respond quickly, I think that's a debate, Representative, that you and I could have for quite a while, because I would also respond to you. Funny how we count an unborn child in the definition of what constitutes a family for purposes of determining premiums, but we're not going to give that child the same rights in other circumstances. So it's kind of like a dog chasing its tail on this. I think, again, that even though we might disagree on certain situations, I think our goal together is the same, maintaining the integrity of the program, and that's all I was trying to do here.
President Emmer, have you gotten any preliminary indications of what kind of savings might be involved if all these things were implemented?
Mr. Chairman, all I can go on is the most recent information from the auditor's office that says they estimate that the program's net loss, this is in the 2003 auditor's report, we estimate that the program's net loss in premiums due to differences in Minnesota Care determinations and actual income was about $14 million. I think that's a good start. The numbers that I pulled out of the report said anything from $5 to $20 million.
Well, I think we're going to need to get this fiscal order to get more precise numbers.
On the surcharge, I was just wondering where the 1% came from and if the state puts an account that earns more than 1%, how that would work. I mean, I know the courts set annually kind of the judgment percentage amount. I was just wondering where you came up with the 1%, and it's a small detail, I suppose.
That's
but
Emma?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, I thought I came up with 2%.
It's a 2% surcharge, but the interest rate is 1%.
That, I believe, came from House Research. That was not mine.
And that's just a number chosen somehow. Okay.
Sure. Yeah, it does seem like you could probably tie that to something that's a little more fluid and flexible, but that's fixable. Yeah. That's going to go back.
Mr. Chair and Representative Emmer, if this passes, will more people who are currently on Minnesota Care lose Minnesota Care? And how many?
Mr. Chairman, Emmer. Representative Goodwin, as I've learned around here, people pick whatever number they want out of the sky. Again, the purpose of this, the answer I'm going to give you is to maintain the integrity of the program for the people that truly are most in need so that it's available. It might some people who possibly should be accessing the private health care system have to go find private health care? I think that's entirely possible, but I may also argue with you that it's entirely appropriate, too. This is all about love. It might be tough love, but it's all about love.
All right, let's move on. Oh, one more question, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, that's a pretty good lawyer answer, attorney answer, but...
Never heard a lawyer talk
about
love.
Not the love part. But the truth of the matter is we do have to try to estimate the impact of everything we do on the people of this state. So I would suggest that, you know, you look at, see how many people actually lose Minnesota Care. So we know that, and plus the fiscal impact of that. And not according to the legislative auditor's report, because that's... So 2 years old now, but and I don't think you adopted everything in the legislative auditor's report in your bill here, but for this part of it, what the fiscal note will be.
Mr. Chairman, I think
we're requesting a fiscal note, and that detail should give us some of those answers. Representative Trumba?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of questions. If a college student is 18 or over and then they're independent, can they apply for Minnesota Care under this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, under this bill?
Yeah.
Anybody can apply. Will they get it? I don't think so.
One of the things colleges...
Representative.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Talk about is their concerns because most college institutions do not provide insurance for the students. Is the fact that they have a lot of students without insurance, and then it ends up being a big challenge for them. And so if they met the income guidelines, why couldn't they? Why would you exclude them?
We are beginning to go down the path of evaluating, criticizing. I mean, it's important you understand, but we don't have to agree here with the policy that's being proposed.
Mr. Chair, I'm not asking for an agreement. I'm just asking, you know, what is the monetary reason for that? I'm confused, I guess.
First Amendment? Mr. Chairman, I believe I said this at the outset, Representative Otremba, two things that I disagree with, and perhaps I disagree with you. If we had intended this program for college kids, college-age kids who are attending school and don't have access to insurance, then I think that's how it should have been set up originally. My understanding of the program, and granted I'm new, but my understanding of the program, it was created for hard-working families that don't have any other coverage. And what we've got now is we're covering a lot of college students in addition to the hard-working families. And we've got people that are using this as a financial planning device. They retire early, they use this program, and then they access a different program later. I think they should take care of themselves.
Well, Mr. Chair, I disagree with some of that because I think we also established the Health Care Access Fund to be specifically for Minnesota Care, and we kind of dipped into that. So to say we're losing money or costing us too much money when the money, you know, there's actually a surplus in that. My other question is the auditor's report, and you used, because I remember when they went over the auditor's report when we were in front of committee, and, you know, they said some were overcharged, some were undercharged, and they had no idea how many were overcharged and undercharged. So I was wondering where you got, when they said between 5 and 20 million, what made you choose 14 million as your number, rather than saying we really don't know?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Otremba, all I can do is quote for you from the actual report where it reads, "We estimate that the program's net loss in premiums due to differences in Minnesota care determinations and actual income was about $14 million. And it goes on, the language says, "We estimate that Minnesota Care lost about $20 million in premiums during the year," which would be, I believe, fiscal year 2001 is what they were using.
And
so my numbers may be low.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Chair. The fact is they really don't know, and they're guessing because they don't know. They really don't know. It's just a guess on whether or not they overestimated or underestimated. Picking 10 or whatever the numbers are isn't a check.
May I suggest, Representative Tremba, let's not get hung up on the number because we're not going to book that number. We'll have to get a formal fiscal note before we can book anything if we do this. So that'll be follow-up. Representative Howell, I'd like to move on so we get a chance to hear some of the other proposals. Anything for
not
further for understanding?
Bill, more to you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for you. Might any of these bills be adopted, or ideas, not bills yet, might any of these ideas be adopted into the omnibus bill?
Every one of these is a legitimate prospect. Typical every year, and Representative Bergeron is famous for moving a bill out of almost entirely brand new things. I try not to do that. I try to do as much as we can to see that there's some public exposure ahead of time. But I would consider these plus other ideas that I'm open as a chair as I put a bill together, a new bill that you'll have a chance to see and the public will have a chance to comment on. So every one of these ideas are prospects, legitimately.
Mr. Chair, to that point, that's what the committee process is about, and hearing all the other bills that we have, I think it's legitimate that we ask the merits of all of these, but that's just my opinion.
I don't know how many times I need to make this reminder to people. I could have, as a chair, not had this time together. I could have not invited the DFL caucus to share ideas for your ideas for savings. I could have done like has typically been done for all the time I've been here for the chair to put together on my own. I'm trying to be as open as I can. But remember, none of this slips by because this all comes back to you in an omnibus bill for which you will have every opportunity to deal with, to amend, to hear public testimony. I think it's more open what I'm doing now. If it turns out the DFL caucus doesn't like this process, we could go back to a more closed process. I don't think you want that. I just really don't want that. That's kind of good one.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to go back to more open process because I was around here when there were other majorities, both parties, and we voted on stuff that went into an omnibus bill as they came up. And I just would like to ask you to make sure when the omnibus bill comes out, to make sure that we have the actual number of people that are losing health insurance under all of these proposals that have come forth and the cost that of doing that, because every one of these bills we have heard lately and not been able to vote on have different kinds of cuts. It's looks like a Minnesota Care massacre to me, and I think that we need to know exactly, we need good fiscal numbers on how many people are going to lose care under all these proposals, because there's going to be a significant number.
Representative Goodman, if you have any really good alternative ideas, I'm looking forward to hear them. I've looked at this list, and it's an interesting list of the spending more but not saving a dime, and that's not going to help do what you want to even do. What's in working?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To that point, this whole exercise was to be a discussion of alternatives. And what alternatives are you bringing to the table? I was looking through the DFL list, and it's interesting, and there's some things that I think a lot of us would like to do, some things I have concerns about. But in doing a little rough calculation of ones that have actual dollar amounts by them, every one of them, by the way, on your list is additional spending, every one of them. If you look at the first one, it says no cost, but there would be some cost for administration, I'm assuming. The total that I came up with was somewhere about $218 million in additional spending. If you count all the question marks where there wasn't any estimate, I mean, I'm sure that would add several tens of millions to the list. And I'm assuming that the minority caucus does not support the governor's cuts. So I'm assuming you're starting out at current law base, which means you got to add another million or 80 million or so to restore the proposals from the governor on Minnesota Care. So where we're at is, if you supported the Dorman-Grilling amendment, instead of the discussion being all about that money going to education, it's pretty much all going to the human services pot. And there's no way to put another dime into education because all the money is being used in the human services pot. And one of my criticisms in 03 was that the majority caucus was pretty much used as a punching bag for every cut that was proposed and made in law, and there wasn't any alternatives proposed. I have not seen them. I would love, if you want to dust off the 03 alternative that balances $4.5 billion, I'd love to see it because I never saw it on one place. What was done was in every committee you'd use the same $60 or $70 million in, you know, supposed corporate loopholes. You can't spend a dollar more than once, and that's what we're doing here. So I'm interested to see how this, I'd like to request of the fiscal analyst that we get a fiscal note on each one of these bills, or that we request that from the administration, and then we can add all that up. We can ask each committee to do that, and we can see at the end of the day what the DFL alternative is, how much is that going to cost, and I'd like to know how it's going to be funded. What taxes are going to be raised? Is it going to be just the tax on the top earners? Because I don't think there's enough there if you double or triple that rate to get that much money out of it. But what we're seeing here is not alternatives to cuts, not anything to address some of the issues that we like to address, the tougher kids, the COLAs. We're adding additional money onto the base budget and not considering any kind of cut or reform.
Well, let's bring it back to, we'll have a chance to discuss the DFL recommendations. I'm sorry I let it kind of drift there. Let's go back and hear the additional, I think we have three more ideas to hear that Republicans have put together that are really alternative savings changes. We can agree or disagree, but at least so you have an idea that there's some of this work going on. Let's see, Representative Powell had one. Maybe he's not back.
He left it with me, Mr. Chairman. I can describe it, but I can't.
Well, how about if we do? We could send mine around. Mine's fairly simple. Let's do that one. And as it's coming around, members, the idea is relatively simple. I don't know that we'll necessarily accumulate any savings in this next biennium, but it does strike me as we're moving tens of thousands of people off Minnesota Care who were very pleased to participate in paying premiums, that now we're moving into MA, and that may be better for them. But at least as we currently operate, we are unable to collect any premiums, at least as I understand it. I've gone through other states, and it sure looks to me like there's some states in their Medicaid programs that actually do collect premiums. So the bill doesn't do anything more than just ask the commissioner to seek federal waivers to allow us to charge premiums. What I say specifically, at least as a start point, so we have some kind of way to know what we're talking about, would be just to adopt and use the Minnesota Care sliding fee premiums as our basis for it. But it would be applying it to our medical assistance program. That's the idea. Any questions for the idea? Doesn't help me?
Chairman Bradley, before I get to this, I sort of agree with you that we're going to have a lot of proposals here today, and we can, most of the questions ought to be directed at understanding what's in them, and we'll see some of them again and some we won't see again. Do you think this will be allowed to the premium charge on
once in a while, apparently, to be honest with you, I don't know for sure. To me, it seems to me to be eminently fair to do this. We were doing it under waivers. We previously had waivers to allow us to do this when it was called Minnesota Care, but in fact, people were technically eligible for MA. So I could easily enough argue that the precedent has already been set. But I think we have absolutely nothing to lose, and in general, in something that's pretty popular where people feel some ownership on a fairly fair level. So I can't tell you for sure, but I think it's worth a try, and we ought to make it happen. And I believe, I mean, as I said, I went through all the states, and if I remember right, there were several states that it sure looked like were already having premiums in the Medicaid programs. Any further questions for clarification? None? Let's move on then to Jim. Is Jim here? No. Well, then let's try to do them. If you think, let's go ahead and send Representative Powell's around, because I do want to have an opportunity to respond.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know where the actual copies are of
it's already handed out. Yeah, it should be. I believe it's 2388.
House Bill 2388. What it basically does is make a clarification to current law that no, we are not paying for gender reassignment surgery. Apparently, there's been some loopholes, and the state has been paying for this in certain instances, and this closes the loopholes.
Yeah, and I'm somewhat familiar with this, members. As I understand, well, you can read the language. We actually passed this several years ago. And I'm not sure that I can entirely understand how the loophole works. It apparently is under this began receiving gender reassignment services, which has been interpreted very, very broadly. So we have been continuing to pay for about two or so a year of these. And I think the legislative intent is there. This has been enough years. So the idea is to stop paying for it, and instead of having that loophole, to take it out. So that's what the bill would do. President Huntley?
Well, you know, it is two people a year, and no one does this without a lot of thought and without the advice of physicians. And it's under the advice of a physician that they undergo this kind of surgery. So I don't know why we, if they're eligible for the program, I don't know why we wouldn't pay for it.
I don't want to get into a debate on the merits of it. The fact of the matter is that the legislature already expressed its opinion by passing the law in the first place. All this does is clarify that if the time has passed, we shouldn't be continuing to see it, and the legislative intent ought to be fulfilled. So it's a matter of understanding it.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could just violate what I just said previously, 13 of us voted against this, I must say, and we're all still here.
So we're outnumbered. Representative Goodman, did you have clarification to this bill?
I don't know if I should. Mr. Chair and Representative Wilkin, what your language reads here is that sex reassignment surgery is not covered, but you've crossed out the part of and related services. So they can have all the services working up to that surgery, but not the surgery the way that you're... And they can have the services after the surgery if they've paid for the surgery, but not the surgery itself.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, I appreciate the advice. It's not my bill, but we'll tighten it up for you.
I think it could use a little... Good idea. Best contribution of the day.
Well...
Okay, for clarification then. The other one is Representative Abler's, and we've got members who are covering multiple committees, but I'm fairly familiar with this. This is House File 2390 that I believe what in the process of being distributed. I know that I have received, and perhaps some of the other members have frequently received, and I think it's at least merits enough for the idea to be here. We don't have specific estimates, but the proponents of this have suggested that we're talking about upwards of $1 million a year for something that is fairly well agreed in the medical world is not a medically necessary, unless under certain circumstances. So the idea is that we would not continue to pay under our health programs for circumcisions unless there's established religious purposes or it's been determined specifically medically necessary. That's what it would do. Any discussion? Good.
good.
And Mr. Chair, well, we get into any sort of conflict with certain religious groups.
But there is a. If you look in the language, it does allow for an exception for a well-established religious practice. Yeah, and so it was put together thoughtfully. I know sometimes we can chuckle about this, but I think it was an attempt to put it together thoughtfully, and the groups that have come to me have been fairly thoughtful about their recommendation. So,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, President Tom.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm sure those newborns won't lose anything under this bill. So.
I was trying to avoid that. All right. That's the extent of a collection of ideas that I suggested that be brought forward, at least to give people a chance. This is not easy work. I can tell you that our team has been working really, really hard, looking under every sort of place that we can for specific ideas, because the reality, and I think we do need to sort of set the reality, members, every year that I've ever been here, no matter majority or minority, we've had a time when you come to a point when there's a budget. And from that point on, there's no way to spend more without finding alternative savings. I mean, it's as simple as that. So I think it's time to move to ideas. We have a sheet in front of us that is titled DFL Health Committee Budget Items for Discussion. I'm really hesitant because as I read through this, to me, I thought the ground rules were very, very clear. For example, to provide comprehensive health coverage for working Minnesotans who do not have coverage through an employer has an estimated cost of $51.1 million. That does not meet our ground rules, right?
Mr.
We're not going to spend time in this committee discussing things that are going to spend more money. The instructions were very, very clear.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Goodwin, I was in the middle of a conversation.
I know, but you're not allowing us to present our own proposal. You're presenting our proposal, and you've had all session to present all the Republican bills in this committee. You've had the majority of this committee meeting to present your proposals. Would you please allow us to present
our own? Representative Goodwin, we've heard 35 DFL bills. We spent lots of time on it. The instructions for this meeting were very clear. I don't see how they could have been more clear. I reemphasized them. And we are not here to hear bills to spend more money.
Mr. Chair,
we
have spent over $500 million that I've counted so far in additional funds in this committee. So I think that we need to discuss how we're going to do this and what we see, how we see to pay for these provisions, and you should allow us to discuss this.
That's a good one. Did you not understand that the request was to give ideas for alternative savings, priorities? That was very, very clear in my written instructions. Did you not understand that?
We have a say in what we present to you and how we present it as well. So,
Representative Goodwin, the chair typically sets the agenda for a meeting. I set the agenda in a fair, open kind of way to allow for a discussion. It is not going to be helpful.
Here you did not.
Well, Representative Goodwin, you can disagree with me. But I thought I made it clear. I repeated it to you over and over again. I said it openly in the meeting. I can show you the copy of the email that I sent to you. We are not going to spend time in this discussion, and you just heard. I mean, you can agree or disagree with the ideas, but these ideas are legitimately ideas that try to find us ways that we can find alternative savings so that we can do the priority things that we want. So,
Mr. Chair, if you let us present it, you'll see that we are choosing priorities and in the process we'll be getting other things to.
Let's go through them one at a time, and if you are unable to say that there's savings in it, then we'll just move on to the next one. So let's start with whoever wants to talk about enable small employers. Well, President Goodwin, it seems you have a hard time understanding.
I think you have a hard time sharing any power in this committee, Mr. Chair. And it's all about you. All about you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, we have a limit on the amount of money we have available to us. It's not unlimited. We can't just adding. And referring to what you said earlier about the bills that spend more money, those are laid over for possible inclusion. There's nobody on this committee has ever had
for possible inclusion to that.
What's that?
Let us have bills laid over for cops.
I think there have been some, and this was a very specific hearing to hear alternatives for savings. And we need to do that so that we can include.
You can also identify priorities, Representative Wilkin, and we have different priorities than you, but you will not allow us to give those priorities.
No, Mr. Chairman, I believe you're going to be allowing amendments to the omnibus bill, and that's exactly what Representative Goodwin's looking for.
Well, I would think so. That's Representative Wilkin, the typical way we work. Every one of these things, if you can find $50 million to do the second one, and want to offer an amendment to send people home from nursing homes or whatever it could be, that's certainly open to amendments when we do the omnibus. That's the typical way in which these additional ideas are handled. If you still want to go through Representative Huntley, you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, there are no targets. We've had a governor's proposal. You don't have any targets. We don't have any targets. We're not going to abide by your targets. We don't feel that we have to. We can make amendments on anything we wish to do. You've heard bills that already that will spend $286.8 million more than in the base budget. And I will say that the first item does not cost any money. For the state, the intent of that was that the whoever buys into those two programs under this proposal would pay the full cost, and if there's administrative cost, that would be part of their premiums. The second item, which goes back to reversing the Minnesota care cuts we did 2 years ago, takes the $51 million out of the health care access fund where we have a surplus. There is a huge surplus. We have not.
Do you understand that there's no surplus in the governor's proposal, and that's our base start point?
Well, Mr. Chair, if you're telling me you're going to come up with a bill that simply is the governor's proposal and there'll be nothing else done to it?
Huntley, I think you can sense that we're looking for alternatives to it, but there has to be a start point, and I suggested that we have a start point. All right, why don't you go ahead and continue? So you're proposing there you would spend an additional $50 million.
Out of the health care access fund, yes. And I don't know if other members want to chip in on some of these other ones, but certainly the number one priority of the House DFL caucus is to reverse the cuts were made in Minnesota Care and restore it to a program that helps hardworking Minnesotans get health care.
All right. You want to quickly go through the others? I mean, these are wonderful if we were sitting here with a ton of money to spend, but I'd just like to know how many people we're going to deny nursing home care or group home care or mental health services or something else in order to do what you're trying to do. It's easy to spend, but somewhere along the line, you've got to meet the responsibility of balancing the checkbook. This isn't going to balance the checkbook.
What you're doing is, for instance, in one of the bills we heard is to cut people off of Minnesota Care, off of dental care, so that you can provide dental care to people with disabilities. What you're attempting to do here is kick people off of health care programs to provide a COLA for healthcare workers. My position is certainly wealthy enough to provide healthcare for everybody that works.
Well, Senator Huntley, I don't know where we expect to get those revenues from. We have targets. We have at least a budget, the limits have been set already. Budget resolution has been set already. We're all smart enough around this table to recognize that we're going to live within constraints. And you can talk all day about we'd love to do all these things, and I know that you have no problem spending, and I respect that. But ultimately, we're going to live within that budget resolution, and ultimately we're going to live within targets. And remember, we have a budget that the governor's proposed, which will increase spending for health and human services 15%. 15% increase. these would be all on top of that, from at least what you're describing. So, I mean, that's nice to do, but actually some of us have, and I've been here when I was in the minority, and was here when the then chair of the committee was doing almost exactly the same thing I'm doing, and that is living within the means that the committee had. This is way beyond the means. I mean, you're certainly free to have these ideas, and if you think you can find a way within the confines of our budget limits to do some more of these with amendments, you're free to do that when it comes forward. But unfortunately, we're drifting away from the intent of today because we're not getting any ideas out of this of ways to be more efficient, reprioritize. I will admit some of those things that you've heard in terms of suggestions that we make do recognize that I do place as a priority making sure that we're helping the most vulnerable people, that is disabled or vulnerable seniors, above what we can do for able-bodied adults without children. I admit that's prioritization. Doesn't mean we don't have some safety net. We have a safety net when it's all done that is superior. As a matter of fact, it's a safety net for adults without children that you can't find in any state in our region. You'd like to do more? Well, then the challenge is find the money. Is there anything else? Because I don't see anything in here that's going to provide us any savings. Am I correct in that, Representative Huntley?
Well, Mr. Chair, your savings that you're referring to are state budget. Some of these savings would actually, some of our proposals would actually save money to the healthcare system because when you kick hardworking Americans off of healthcare, they don't go away. They're still going to go to the emergency room. They're still going to get treatment, and they're going to get treatment. Representative Powell just had a bill that would try to encourage people not to go to emergency rooms, but when you kick people off of health care, they're still going to be here in the state of Minnesota. They're still going to go to hospitals, and they're still going to be treated. And if the hospital doesn't get paid, they will simply raise their rates to everybody else. And so you'll see increased premiums because of the people that we're kicking off of our health care programs.
Well, Huntley, can I ask, though, I asked a specific question. As I read through these, I did not see any proposal that had any savings to it that might be used to help out. I mean,
Mr. Chair.
The fact of the public programs, I mean, certainly Representative Abrams' committee has been open to suggestions in the private marketplace, but we are going to manage a budget, which is the general fund budget for the public assisted health care programs. And I'm asking, are there any savings in these for the public assisted health care programs?
Mr. Chair,
President Thiessen.
I have two things that I'd like to bring up. One is number seven, and it's a little bit misleading because it talks about the $1.9 million for the suicide prevention grants. But the House File 891 relates to the mental illness, the formulator for mental illness drugs. And I would like to get a fiscal note on that bill because I think that managing those medications more effectively actually would save the state more money. And right now it requires people that are on drugs treating some mental illnesses to go to generics, and that's not always the most effective place to be. And so if that is one where I think that there, I don't know for sure, but I think it possibly could be savings.
And I would welcome that. I mean, it's a good idea, and we still have some time. You know, if you can pursue that and come back with, I mean, I was just looking at it. It's had 1.9.
No, I understand it. And the other one kind of builds on a little bit of what Representative Emmer was talking about, and we talked about it a little briefly, but some legislation related to, it's really about gathering more information, I think, for this biennium, but going forward, I think, would save money. And it relates to getting more information about who the employers are of people that are applying for and on Minnesota Care. Both from the perspective, it's House File 88, I believe. It's not listed out here, and I don't have the language, I'm sorry. But both from the perspective of making sure that people are appropriately applying for Minnesota Care, and from the perspective of finding out if there are, I think there may be some large employers in the state who are using Minnesota Care as their insurance, as their health insurance for their employees, as opposed to kind of stepping up to the plate and providing and very profitable companies, I might add, instead of stepping up to the plate and providing insurance themselves in the private sector. And I think that that actually would be very valuable information for us to gather to kind of understand some of those dynamics. And so I don't know if there'd be savings immediately, but I think that information could lead us in the direction of longer-term savings. And I don't think it would cost money.
Mr. Chairman?
I'm
curious as to how that saves money, just knowing what companies are offering coverage and which companies are not offering coverage.
I think that we could... thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that we could make some policy decisions based on having better information about those circumstances and putting in place incentives or obstacles for that kind of practice to be happening. I don't think it's fair for us to be shifted. I don't think it's fair for a really profitable company, going to Representative Emmer's point about who ought to be on MinnesotaCare. If you have a really profitable employer that's, you know, an international company that's employing thousands and thousands of people and making huge profits for their shareholders, I don't think the people of Minnesota, taxpayers, should be paying to provide health coverage for the employees of that company when the employer itself has so much in profits and could be doing it on their own in the private sector. And so that's what, getting that information, I think, may allow us to make some better policy decisions.
What struck me a little about that, Representative Thiessen, the profile you just described, you don't need anybody empowering you. You can, I mean, the company you're talking about would be a piece of cake to go find out. And then if you do find violators, then construct something. I mean, I don't know what it'd be, and I'm pretty sympathetic, actually, to kind of the theme they're talking about.
Well, and honestly, Mr. Chair, I think that the department probably has most of the information, but they're not necessarily, I haven't been that forthcoming in pulling it together. So if, to the extent that there's any pressure that could be put on from your side of the aisle as well, that could be helpful.
What's striking about it, Representative Thiessen, as I said, I'm kind of sympathetic. Let's just hypothesize that you're right and there's...
And
the violator
that they found
right.
This to be the case.
But what I'm looking for, though, is so what would we do about it? You know, what would be the kind of policy that would make some sense? That's been sort of missing link for me about where we go from.
And that's fair, Mr. Chair. And I know that, and I know I'm not wed to anything, but there are states currently that are providing penalties for companies that meet a certain profile and who are shifting a large percentage of their employers onto public assistance. Placing penalties on those companies or surcharges or some sort. So you're at least capturing back some of the subsidy that the taxpayers of that particular state are providing to those companies. And so there could be financial mechanisms you could put in place for people that meet, and it's a policy discussion about who meets that profile. But maybe we can talk about this further, but the first step is getting the information, I think. And I don't think it's ready for prime time to take any more action this session, but if we could get the information, I think...
Well, I'm hot to do those things that give us some return.
No,
notwithstanding, I think you're onto something. I just don't exactly know sort of the what you do about it kind of thing. I'm happy to work with you on that.
Okay.
Good point.
Well, the state of Maine has passed some laws that have made it through several courts, I must say, on forcing companies to... provide health care to their employees. It's you have to get around the ERISA exemptions. I did have an idea that might save some money in the state budget, and that would be to take Representative Wilkins' bill that would eliminate maternity coverage for small businesses between 1 and 14 employees, because all the women that they've hired that... become pregnant will be eligible for medical assistance.
Mr. Chairman?
So what they're doing is they're shifting their costs from the business to the state in medical assistance, because the medical assistance eligibility limits are so broad that practically any woman that would be working for a company like that would be eligible for MA.
I don't recall seeing that in the fiscal note, Representative Wilkins.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, is Representative Huntley referring to the bill that just passed with 91 votes?
That's the bill.
Okay. That's not current law, so if we stopped it, it wouldn't save the state any money. If your hypothesis applies, But my hypothesis is that the people who get that are either going to, who buy that product are either about to drop coverage or are uninsured right now. So it would probably save the state money because we'd be covering more of the uninsured, making sure that people, instead of being required to either buy the Cadillac or you can walk under current law, now they can buy a Chevy that suits them just right.
Well, I think either way, we're not able to gather any savings or costs to this committee on that one because it's first of all, it's not actually current law, but secondly, it wasn't scored to your opinion, nor is it scored to that opinion.
Right.
So either way, it's hard for me to find any money. Any further suggestions or ideas to the committee? Professor Meekin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to, just about the DFL plan that we've offered here in general, this is a genuine alternative that would actually save money in the long run. And I think that, you know, we were talking about whether we should have a more open process here. I think that we also need to have a more, I guess, far-reaching, broader-viewed process that we take into consideration the costs, just not short-term, but the long-term costs of the policies we enact here as well. And I think, unfortunately, oftentimes we make decisions on short-sighted, I guess, information. And I think that we need to have a broader definition of savings. We have a rather narrow definition of savings here, both in terms of you know, how it's going to affect us long-term, and as far as the whole state. We're just looking at state savings here, and Representative Huntley, I think, made it quite clear that this isn't going to be a savings to the private sector. It's actually going to increase costs in the private sector. So I just wanted to make those comments, and we certainly do have the means to ensure that we enact policies that are going to have long-term savings and are going to have savings for both the private and the public sector, not just for the state, but for the private sector as well. Thank you.
Representative Aiken, I am probably as much as anybody want to think strategically and try to think strategically, but it's sort of like a family in an economic crisis. Pretty hard to think about taking actions where you're spending money when you're broke now, even if you think long term. But I mean, I'm sympathetic to the idea of thinking strategically. But I would also sort of comment, having looked through this, I don't know for sure how many, but a good share of these have been a topic of discussions that there have been hearings and discussions in the division. So it's not that some of these sort of deal with the private sector insurance, so which is legitimate for them to be. But I'm back to the practical. I was trying to set up today's meeting for the very practical job that we have in these ensuing weeks. Further discussion, Representative Tremba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to look at the lien piece, the life estates. We know that there's a court ruling that has said that backdating is unconstitutional, and I think it would be in our best interest, policy-wise and monetarily, to at least move forward in the backdating piece of that. The ruling also said that the state is required to pay back all the money that they gleaned, which includes the federal dollars, which we would not be able to recapture from the feds. And so I think leaving this in place, at least the backdating, is very costly to us as taxpayers.
Representative Tremba, that is in my list, and I've been working with Representative Lanning. We've been working with the department. We went from approximately $20 million estimate to go back to eliminate the retroactivity, which I'm very sympathetic to an interim number of about $5.7 million, and now we're back up to about a $14 million as we're trying to refine these estimates. I agree with you. I think that we need to do something. But think of it. I just added potentially a $14 million challenge to an already challenging budget.
But I think, Mr. Chair, the other side of the coin is we now have a court case. It sets precedent. So basically all of them that are going to come to court in front of the department are probably going to win.
And the longer we do that, the more we're going to spend, and the more we're going to, it's going to take us to recapture. So,
but well, I remember, I've reached a point where I agree with you, I think, in concept. Right now I'm down at the pragmatic dollars and cents. I mean, how do we find, and this is, I mean, these ideas and others, frankly, are in part because I think one of our first expenditures is going to be to buy that back somehow.
Mm-hmm.
But $14 million is a lot of money.
I understand that. And you know how I've been working on this for probably what most people in here think is too long, but
yeah.
I am concerned about the increase in dollars that we are going to be paying the longer we leave this on the books.
Right, I agree. Further discussion, members? Well, it's been an interesting loving. Let's see, finish then.
On that note, I just want to point out a couple of things. First of all, the governor's proposal, I think, increases this area by 15%. And with that being said, I know for all those listening, Representative Bradley has came to me and other members many times with great sincerity about how can we all get together and bring up ideas where we can live within our means. I mean, we are in deficit spending as a state. We look at, let's just break it down. We're spending more than we're taking in. And Representative Bradley has done everything he can to engage both sides of the aisles as far as ideas go. You look at the list that my colleagues on this side of the aisle put out today. I mean, these aren't easy things to talk about. These aren't fun things to talk about. But in a time of deficit spending, even looking at a 15% growth in this area, we have to be creative. We have to think outside of the box. We have to look at different options. And I look at the DFL proposal in front of me here, and I see $51 million additional, $1 million additional, $107 million additional, $1.9 million additional. I appreciate that, and I look forward to those proposals and bills as far as amendments go as we mark up our bill. But again, it goes back to Representative Bradley, I believe, was pretty sincere saying, you know, what are some creative ideas that we can look at to find some savings? So I applaud him for that, and I want to point out the whole bipartisan talk that we've all seemed to wrap our arms around and love saying. And here's a pretty good example today of it not happening. We have, just on this committee alone, we have Representative Goodwin not wanting to participate in the process to the point where she folds up her bags and leaves. Representative Powell doing interviews in the paper personally saying that I hate people, me and my colleagues. And I'd love to talk a little bit more about that. These are not constructive things to do or say as we put this budget together. And we can politically talk about it and call each other names or do whatever, but at the end of the day, we have a budget to put together. The governor's proposed a 15% increase in this area. We're working on proposals, and I guess I would just, and maybe I'm young and naive, but I would hope that we all could get together on some ideas in the next week to make this part of the budget a better part and get creative in ways we can save and spend money. I'll shut up with that.
Mr. Tal?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I look at all of these proposals, ideas, they're nothing but more cuts. If we're going to cut, it's easy to cut if you don't think about who's going to be impacted by all of these cuts. So I personally like to think that there are people outside of here that will be impacted by what we cut here. They're not savings. They're just cuts. They're going to cut more people off Minnesota Cares with these new ideas. And then we'll continue to do that. And these are people. I went to a lot of testimony. There's this kid. He has schizophrenia. And he's working. He's on Minnesota Care. And Minnesota Care is providing meds so he could work. If he gets cut off, he's going to go on welfare for sure. If he can't get on, if he can't work, if he can't get his drugs, he's going to get on welfare. And we're going to end up paying more. That's really what I'm trying to say here. And if this was a real open process, let's open it up with no restriction. We came in here with so much restriction. The only bills the only ideas that we're going to hear about is ideas how to cut. That's all we do. Cut, cut, cut. So we're going to hurt.
Representative Pinstead.
This will just be a quick point. How do you balance your checkbook at home? You have a limit. You have priorities. You have to make those priorities, and you only have a dollar amount to spend. We are, whether we like it or not, we're confined to a certain spending limit. We don't have the money tree sitting right here where we can just pull additional monies out of to fund every which program. And it's easy. You say it's easy to say cut, cut, cut. Well, it's really easy to say spend, 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 and not worry about where it's going to come from.
Well,
we could debate this back and forth, and I know that's not what Representative Miller wanted to get out of this, but I would be more than happy to talk with you, Representative Fell.
Representative Fell, at home, if the bills come up too high, I go get a second job. You know, if we're going to make that simple, then let's talk about it.
Representative Fell, what if you're already working that second job, and that's where we are?
Well, send my wife to get her second job.
And what if your wife is already working a second job?
Because
she already is, in our analogy. But look, we're probably going too far afield. I do want to try to wrap up. Representative Walker?
I just had to get in on that, Mr. Chair. Thanks for just a second. I apologize to the committee that I wasn't that helpful this morning. I had a bill that was up in another committee looking for the engrossment that is MIA. So I had some difficulties this morning, and I too just wanted to echo what Representative Tao said as it relates to getting a second job. And I heard what you said, Mr. Chair. There comes a time of a split, and I balance my budget, and I struggle as a single mother with a son wearing a size 16, 17 shoe. It's a struggle for me on a regular basis, and I too often get a second job, and I have been one to work three or four jobs when need be, doing growth spurts. But it gets to a point where you can't cut anymore, and individuals and households have cut out cable, they've cut out entertainment, they're using food shelves, they're using the clothing shelves, not just at my mother's place in South Minneapolis, but all throughout the state. And so the balance isn't a true balance, and to get another job is one thing that individuals are doing, but to try to figure out how to survive and not end up having to become poverty-stricken individuals, that these are families that want to make it just like we all do. We have, unfortunately, a society that does not necessarily pay what we want. We have services, and I'm the first to say I'll sign up for a service. I like to go to Target. I love Target. I want to go there. I want individuals working there. I want them stocked. I want somebody friendly at the cashier desk. I want someone at my drugstore. The individuals that work in the drugstore don't make what the pharmacists make. We have our child care providers, the assistance that they pay. We are a society that does not pay adequate wages for the services that we need in the society, and that's just being honest. And so until we figure out how to either raise those wages, we are going to have to sometimes give to the families to make sure that our next door neighbor is being well taken care of, because those are the children that are playing with our children. And we are going to always be at odds, especially in a deficit, as how we move forward. But I do just think that that needs to be talked about also.
Just a little bit of a reminder to Representative Eakin's point to think strategically. If one thinks strategically, Representative Eakin, you'd have to come to a conclusion that we better do something to manage the rate of increase of the Health and Human Services budget. The reality is that we would have to double income tax about every 8 years to keep up with the current rate of inflation. And if we can all draw analogies to our own family, that if our transportation expenses were increasing at that, we'd simply have to find a better way to manage it. And we can, all these kinds of things do is aggravate the problem. We cannot sustain, by any tax policy in the world, a rate of inflation in health and human services that's at its current level. It's just not sustainable, and that begs for better management. And that's the thing we're trying to do. Representative Deacon?
And thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do agree with you. I mean, we have to think strategically. We do have to do something about the rising cost of health care, but I don't believe that the governor's budget does anything to address that issue. Matter of fact, that, I think, exacerbates, his budget actually exacerbates
the problems of rising health care costs, and it's shifting it onto the private sector and shifting the problems down the road, and we're going to face bigger problems down the road. So I think that we've got to do something now, and I think the DFL plan actually does a lot more in terms of heading off some of the problems that we may experience in the future as a result of the governor's budget plan. So, and I believe we do have the means to invest in a healthcare system that will ensure good health in the future. The means are there. We're living in one of the wealthiest states and one of the wealthiest nations in the world. We have the means to do that.
Well, I'm pretty good at math, Representative. I don't see the math. Representative Huntley?
Well, I get most of my figures from the Minnesota's Taxpayer Association, which is a fairly conservative group, but you can believe their numbers. You might not, I might not agree with some of their conclusions, but you can believe their numbers. And Representative Finstead said we should live within our means, and I agree with that, but I'm not sure that the governor saying what we have to live with is what I would say what our society ought to live with. And Minnesota, while yes, it is a high-tax state, always been a high-tax state, probably always will be a high-tax state, but we've gone from the 1960s when we were an average personal income state to now we're number 8 in the country. We're the 8th wealthiest state in the country. And if you look at what the Taxpayers Association said a couple of weeks ago, if you look at state taxes, local taxes, and fees, Minnesota is ranked 22nd highest taxes and fees in the country, and we're the 8th wealthiest. So we have money to make sure that hardworking Minnesota families can have health insurance, and we don't have to cut a single one off.
Well, it's nice, but I'll again say I've looked at the math, and I don't see the math working that way. But well, it's been an interesting discussion. We have no, at this point, there's no future meetings planned. It'll be to the call of the chair, as we have business that we need to attend to. As I indicated to you, it's my desire, with a lot of hard work ahead of us on my own part and on staff part, to put together an omnibus proposal to come to this committee by early next week. And I still welcome, the door is open to ideas. If people have some other creative ideas in the areas of savings so that we can make investments, I welcome those ideas. We're adjourned.